waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So I go back to Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates in her memo yesterday on instructing officials to decline to renew contracts for private prison operators when they expire or to substantially reduce the contract scopes. She said that reducing and ultimately ending our use of privately operated prisons was the goal. And it's about time. And to me, it's about time that we end this idea of privatizing the commons, privatizing that what we used to own, what we used to do for ourselves. It's about time. Ending the privatization of our utilities, ending the privatization of our transportation, ending education, so much of that. And here to talk about the privatization fever, and hopefully now it is broken, I've asked our good friend Mateus Vernango, professor of economics at Bucknell University, also a fantastic blogger over at nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick.
So I look at this as a huge positive step forward. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I think it's a positive step forward. As you suggested, it's been a long period going, probably, if you have to think symbolically, to the fall of the Berlin Wall, in which the notion that the state, because of the Soviet Union, everything the state did was wrong and markets were always right, and so we had to privatize everything, and that was not just a phenomenon in the U.S., it was pushed globally through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund globally. So there was a fever of privatization, which hopefully will start seeing sort of after, I should say now, almost 30 years of clear, excessive fundamentalism and lots of failure, we start seeing a retreat. And in these areas, important because, as you know, there has been this brutal increase in incarceration in the U.S. And so you can see this idea of privatization of prisons as going hand in hand with this neoliberal project of the regulation, of reform of the welfare system, in which people have to work because otherwise they're lazy. And we ended up putting lots of minorities in jail. And that's essentially a way of dealing with surplus labor. So it's one of the things that has helped weaken unions, have helped weaken the labor force in general, the labor force bargaining power in general, and has allowed for stagnating wages and for an economy that works only for the 1% and not for everybody. So this is an important thing. I mean, whether it's enough and whether it will work, that's another question, but it's a movement in the right direction for sure.
Yeah, I mean, because I look at this and, privatization is the only thing, something I think people really started paying attention to here in this country within the last maybe 10 years of going, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea. This is something that internationally, much like the word austerity that we learned during the Obama term, was something globally that was always front and center, especially in the Latin American countries where we saw privatization run rampant.
Sure. So we have extreme experience, and that's why I said going back to the late 80s, because that was central to what in Latin America was known as the Washington Consensus. So these were ideas pushed by the Washington institutions, which in Latin America, those were seen as U.S. Treasury, the IMF, and the World Bank. And they pushed privatization of everything from pension systems and it goes beyond, I should say, it goes all the way to the 70s in all fairness, so some of these policies, but to public utilities, you name it, we have privatized almost everything in Latin America. I should say it happened also, although I have less experience on that area, but it happened also in Eastern Europe and the ex-Soviet Union and several republics, including Russia. Also, in all of those cases, with very negative sort of effects, Normally, you know, what privatization allows for is it restricts services and allows private firms to make more profits by charging higher tariffs. And you know, you can think of the prison, you know, complex, industrial complex in the U.S. as sometimes it's called, as something like that. It costs more, you know, actually to do it that way, and it, you know, and then reaches you know, the pockets of the owners of this corporation. In the case of Latin America, there are a few that cases that have been infamous. I would suggest that the two that come to mind as being sort of prominent are privatization of water in Bolivia, which was a huge failure. It was done in the late 90s, and essentially the notion was the following. You know, what's the idea of privatization? You say, we don't have enough investment, so if the state has no money, it's broke. And so if we open up for the private sector, we'll get all of this huge investment, and because they'll invest a lot and provide more of this, they'll do it more efficiently and at a lower price. But it turns out that in none of those cases you've seen, you know, significant investment, because the investors only come if there's lots of money to be made, and right. Certainly selling water in Bolivia is not a cash cow. So there was no significant investment. So contrary to an increase in investment, there was a decrease. And what they essentially did was, you know, they hiked the tariffs, and so restricted access to clean water to significant amounts of the population. Tried to do crazy things, like didn't allow them to recover, you know, rainwater and other stuff like that. So. So you basically throw a good chunk of the population into low quality services or outside the, you know, the official channels of service, so they don't get clean water, and the people that stay in, because this is a basic need, have to pay considerably more. So you make them poorer, and so the degree of poverty increased. In the case of Bolivia, to the point at which you had both in the 2000s, 2000 and 2005, if I don't remember, I think it was a year before Evo Morales came to power, significant protests both in Cochabamba and La Paz, and which helped bring a left of center government to power. So this was central to that, and that underscores the idea that, you know, markets do certain things right. Don't get me wrong. I mean, certainly, you know, you want markets, but markets don't do everything right, and the provision of certain public goods certainly is not something that we should leave for markets.
Right. You know, things like water, things like prisons, things like education.
Yes. Things like pension funds, you know, which is the other one. I mean, if you listen to, it's still alive, that story. It was all through the 2000s, but, you know, the privatization of Social Security is one of the dangers of a Republican presidency with, you know, Congress and the Senate. You know, if the less likely scenario that, you know, Trump would win, but, you know, it's still a possible scenario. It's not a, you know, I'm always concerned when people say, well, the probability is low. Yeah, but it's not zero. So there is a positive probability of having something like that. And that would be, you know, for sure, one of the things that would be, it has been in, you know, if you look at the websites of all of the main, you know, conservative think tanks, Cato and Heritage and all of those guys, they still talk about privatization of Social Security. And the examples in, say, Argentina or Chile, that this was done in the 80s and 90s, it was a complete failure. So the notion, again, is that the private sector will be more efficient managing this, so they'll charge lower administrative fees, that they will invest the money better, that people would have to be forced to save more, and that would lead to more investment and hence higher rates of growth. And none of those things materialized. And essentially by the 2000s, the government was putting more money than before. And in both Argentina and Chile, in Chile was partially renationalized. In Argentina, it was completely renationalized. And it's, again, a pay-as-you-go system, very much like the U.S. Social Security system. I'm here not suggesting that there are not issues with Social Security. Obviously, as the population, you know, gets older, there are things that have to be done in order to make the system sustainable. One of the good things, I should say, about making a system sustainable is immigration. You know, immigrants tend to be younger, tend to pay payroll taxes, and they reduce the burden on an older generation. So that's, for example, a positive effect of immigration. So privatization failed there too. So this, the private sector is not into the business of helping old people, survive, above the poverty line in old age. So that's not their business.
No, their business is to make money. They want cash. They want it now.
Exactly. They want, the immediate sort of rush of speculative rush of making, with the privatization of this would lead to significant, boom in the stocks of these companies. People will be all happy. They'll put their money there. They cash in, and then they're out. And then the government is left with underfunded pensions that they'll have to provide with now lower revenue from payroll taxes to support those pension systems. So it's a terrible idea.
It is a terrible idea.
It has not worked. So it's not also theoretically terrible idea. It's also that the experiences that exist out there have been incredible failures.
And it's not just Social Security they want to privatize, Mateus. It's state pension funds like here in Pennsylvania and other states where they're just licking their chops to get into the Wall Street hands.
Yes. No, that's what I'm saying. That I think it's one of the most dangerous things that could happen is the privatization. So I don't think we're completely out of the woods that this this legislation to stop reducing the use of private prisons signals the sort of end with the infatuation with privatization. I think it's more related to the fact that they know that the U.S. is completely out of line in terms of how many people are in prison, and that something has to be done in that respect. And well, this is one step: stop using these prisons, which, by the way, they're bad. As almost any of those things that that have a public good sort of component should not be done by market. I should say other things that are relevant to know. I mean, in the case of Russia, which I think it's sort of an extreme example too, the privatization process was incredibly corrupt. It led to, basically directors of the public firms during the Soviet era to become incredibly wealthy. They basically got sweetheart deals, and some of the assets of the public firms, for example, Gazprom, the main natural gas one, and it ended up in the hands of a few oligarchs, as they call it there, and a country, this is typical also of Latin America. You see countries that depend heavily on one commodity for their exports. So in Russia, natural gas is central, and in many Latin American countries, you'll have something like that too. The privatization of these allowed for the enrichment of particular groups, but the country as a whole didn't benefit. So you can think of Putin as essentially being a reaction to this excessive push for privatization, for neoliberal policies that the World Bank and the IMF sort of had, and politically it backfired because, this guy that used to be from the KGB comes back and says, wait, we're enriching a bunch of people and the country's in shatters, and so we renationalized national gas, and now the state has revenues to do a minimum of things. So it's not that unreasonable to understand why somebody like Putin sort of appeared in Russia, given what the privatization process and the excessive sort of reliance on markets led to. And I should note, Chile is often noticed as the exemplar case of Latin America, the country that has done the best and grow faster, and they got rid of that socialist agenda. It turns out that Allende nationalized copper, 40-something years ago, and a military coup with the support of U.S. government brought him down. And the so-called Chicago Boys, were the economists behind, the neoliberal policies there, they privatized everything, including pension funds. The thing that they did not privatize was copper. So copper remains, in the hands of the state in Chile. And one of the effects of that is Chile has always had fiscal revenues and has had enough money not to have external problems, not being able to pay its debt and so on and so forth. So one of the interesting things is that this sort of example of the market economy, market-friendly economy, is actually an economy that has at the core of it nationalized ownership of natural resource.
Well, that I didn't know. But going back to the Russian oligarchs, I mean, I think most of us look at that, at what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union, and go, that was a bad idea to let these handful of people take control of all the industry. But here we don't seem to have that problem, because we didn't have, I don't think, had that kind of initial rush, that it's just been kind of a slow privatization of the commons and of our stuff.
Sure. No, and we have had, you know, going back for ages now. So you have to go to the robber barons, to an economy that is dominated by very few oligopolistic firms. So there is no level playing field. And almost any sector that you go, when people say, think of this, people here resist the nationalization of health. And I don't mean nationalization in the sense that all health will be done by the state, which, you know, I don't know, are more socialist, or, you know, even closer to the British model, you know. You know, something simple, that there is a public option, you know. People resist that sort of stuff. And that's the form it has taken. But, you know, it's very easy to resist, because we do have very few sort of health firms that control the local market. So it's 2-3 at most. And so it's very hard to break that. There's also the resistance from the medical profession and so on and so forth. So it takes a different sort of tone here, but you know, it's essentially the same. You know, when you check, there are studies that show that that Medicare, the administrative costs are about 2% of the operating expenditures of Medicare, and I don't remember by heart the number, but it's I think it was something like 15% or more of the operating expenditures for insurance companies.
Well, so, under Obamacare, they can't spend more than, I think it's either 20 or 25%, because some of them were up above 25%.
And it's an amazing thing that the myth of the market being more efficient resists this obvious sort of concrete examples of the market sometimes not being more efficient. Because in this case, it's how they make their money. They make their money by charging you more and providing less care. And so it's exactly what this is predicated on. So there are certain things that obviously, so you're right. Here we don't have that sort of, you know, same oligarchs, and it's not a recent thing. But think of the oligarchs as the Russian version of our old robber barons. So the Rockefellers and Carnegies and, you know, and whatnot. And we do have something similar in a sense that there is a 1% that is very wealthy, and that basically descends to some extent from the people that made their money. I mean, that's the way to be rich, in all fairness. Trump didn't make his money, he inherited. And so that's the way to be rich, if you inherit money. And so there is a connection. It's not completely different. We don't see it as the Russian oligarchs, but, you know, we have lots of Russian, like Russian oligarchs on Park Avenue.
No, and in places like Wyoming with the Koch brothers. So there you go.
Yes. Yeah.
So last question I've got for you. Do you see this as that step to maybe we have an awakening in this country, where maybe we start pushing back? Because there's an awful lot of conversation around public-private partnerships and transportation, which, you know, I don't know, throwing up cash boxes everywhere doesn't seem like a real good investment to me. I'm curious your thought.
I'm skeptical. I wish, you know, I what I do see on the positive side is that there is more comprehension, there is more since the crisis and the Occupy Wall Street and now the Bernie movement, there is more understanding that inequality is a big problem, that it's at the heart of all of our sort of social issues, and that some of these things have to be addressed. The notion that there is a role for the public sector in curtailing the power of corporations, and so I think it's harder to fool people, and so maybe we are on the verge of something. But, you know, I'm in the sense that, you know, if this sort of movements continue, which I don't see any reason they won't, there might be a possibility of changing things. On the other hand, it's important to remember that the political system is filled with money coming from corporations and wealthy people, that, you know, that's something that has not changed yet, and that they will remain very strong, and the lobbying power of them in Congress will be, you know, incredible. So even if there is this understanding, it might be difficult to change things.
Yeah, thank you, Citizens United. Mateus, I appreciate you taking some time for us, filling us in. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you. No, thank you.
Great talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.